So I'm very pleased to be here and have the opportunity to talk to your students. Many of you are undergraduates, or are you MBA students, or variety? We had a great event this morning. It was rousing. We started out with your concert choir, and then we saw a sports event briefly. And then we had a wonderful address from Dr. Eaton, who gave a talk about his philosophy of, or SPU philosophy of education. And I thought it worked in very well with what I was talking about, because I wanted to talk about the economic situation that we're in, and I think it has cultural bases. And Dr. Eaton was talking about the education and mission and how it affects our culture. And he used the phrase habits of the heart, which refers to just the fundamental purpose and attitudes of purpose and meaning that we have in our lives. And I think those are tied in with the economic crisis. So let me just say, I'm going to be talking about the crisis that we're in now, which is the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression. And I'm going to do it from a perspective as a behavioral economist. That is, that I think human psychology matters, and we can't understand it in purely technical terms. So the problem is, maybe I'll put it at very basic level to start with. We had enormous bubbles in the stock market and the housing market. By a bubble, I mean prices got elevated because of investor enthusiasm. In the 1990s, we had a stock market boom. And everybody thought they were going to get rich. And many of my students thought they were going to go into investment banking. And some of them did, by the way. In the 1990s, it was a better opportunity than it is now. And then there was a housing bubble in the early 2000s. And that they both burst, which means that the enthusiasm that we had eventually faltered and prices fell. And when prices fell, it changed everything. And so then people's balance sheets were destroyed, their assets fell, their debts exceeded what they owned. Businesses found that they were insolvent because they owned assets that whose value had dropped. And it led to a whole funk over the whole economy. Households stopped spending because, hey, it's bad times. And who knows, I'm not unemployed yet, but I could be. Everyone's saying the unemployment rate is going up. So they stopped spending, and if they stopped spending, then businesses can't sell anything. And so they've got to lay more people off, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Everyone expecting the worst, it actually happens. And it's almost comical if you could keep your sense of humor about it. It makes no sense. Everybody is cutting back. Why? Because they think everyone is cutting back. So I think that it has to be a largely, I call that psychological, because it's not necessarily madness or insanity. It's something about how we react to each other and our contagion of feelings and emotions. The term animal spirits is the title of my new book with co-author George Akerlof. And it's a term that the economist John Maynard Keynes used in 1936, which is often quoted. You may not have heard of it, but animal spirits refers to the animating spirit that makes people go and do things. And Keynes said that, defining what he meant by animal spirits, if we were all really rational and calculating, we might all just give up, right? Because, you know, you'd all think, well, you know, I'm just probably average. I'm never going to, right? I'd be realistic. I'm never going to amount to anything special in the world, so I better not even try, right? But somehow, we humans don't come to that conclusion very often. And the people who do need Prozac or something. That's the problem. The problem is that sometimes the economy has too much animal spirits, and we're too optimistic that everything's going to go well. I mean, it's going to all be easy. I don't want to really do hard work. I just want to do something like invest in the stock market and not get rich. But then it goes into another period where everything just seems so difficult and we're all kind of in a collective depression. That's what animal spirits is about. So I wasn't going to talk too long here, but I wanted to show you my slides, the same slides that I showed this morning, but I take it not many of you were there at this extravaganza. It was really a big event, I have to say. Looking out at a sea of 1,400 people, as a speaker, it makes an impression. Even if they were all enjoying their breakfast, not necessarily all paying attention. But I wanted to show you the data on the bubbles we've experienced, and then maybe with a little bit of commentary, and then I'll open it up for questions. So I said before that the precursors to this crisis were two bubbles, the stock market bubble and the housing bubble. Okay, we call them bubbles, meaning that they consisted of no more substance than a bubble, soap bubble. It gets bigger for a while and amazes you, and then it's gone. Because it can only get so big and it's going to burst, right? It's the same with these. But I wanted to show you pictures of them. This is graphs. This is the blue line on that picture is the real stock market price. It's the Standard & Poor's 500, but I've corrected it for inflation. And I have it from 1871 to last Friday. Okay, I like to get it completely up to date. And you can see that I can't do my laser pointer, you can be seen, can you see that? That is the year 2000. Okay, I can do it over here. Wow, these lasers are amazing, aren't they? Right there. And we are down 53% from that peak. So this period in the 90s is the bubble period, and then we see a crash. By historical standard, we've been through some extraordinary recent behavior. If you compare, when did we have an experience like that before? Well, I would say once before, and that was that date right there. You know what that date is? 1929. And everything was smaller in those days, so don't be misled by that. But in terms of percentage changes, it was something amazing. Look what the stock market did. This is called the Roaring Twenties. Right? The stock market was just going up, like exponentially, faster and faster. And then it dropped 80%. And that was the Great Depression. So what was going on in those times? Well, in the Roaring Twenties, somehow people got very optimistic. They like to use the word new era. Everything was moving fast. Everyone got their first radio. There were no radios before the 1920s, and you started listening to radio shows every night. There was Rudy Valley, and there was Amos and Andy, and just like it is now, all of a sudden. And then you got your first car. Everyone was getting prosperous. They got their first washing machine and their first refrigerator. By the end of the 20s, they thought, we're moving into a modern times now compared to where we were in, say, 1919. And no one could imagine that anything could go wrong, but then suddenly we had this Great Depression. And it represented really the burst of this bubble in the 1920s. The green line shows earnings, corporate earnings, over the period. And you note that the earnings went down, a little bit hard to see, after 29, and they also went down recently. Look at the collapse in earnings recently. Mm-hmm. It's fallen, actually it's negative for the fourth quarter of 2008. So something is collapsing fast, same as it did in 29. But I don't think that's the cause of the collapse. It's a sign of the collapse, that we've somehow gotten very discouraged, and so we're not buying, so companies aren't making money. And to any one person, it seems like I'm perfectly rational. I'm just responding to, you know, my company is not making any money anymore. I don't have any choice. I have to lay people off. And other people say, but you know, I could get laid off, so I'm not going to spend any money. Everyone individually feels rational, but somehow it's collective madness. To quote Herbert Hoover, president at the beginning of the Great Depression, the fundamentals are sound. Nothing has happened. And he thought that by saying that, it would bring people back, but it didn't work. The next slide is just the price-earnings ratio. This is the stock price divided by the 10-year average of earnings. And that's the blue line. This is a measure of how expensive the stock market is. And you can see how expensive it was in 1920. Look what happened. The price-earnings ratio went up from about 5 in 1919 to about 35 in the space of one decade. It just, people started valuing the same thing up more and more. But it did even more in 2000. It just jumped up to about 45. And then it crashed. Now it's down to 14.89. Now, some economists say they have theories about why this happened. Some people say it's due to interest rate change. Well, I have the long-term interest rate shown as the red line, but I don't think it explains it historically. So I think it is animal spirits that are growing and collapsing. So we're down to 14.89. Where do we go from here? Good question. If we continue down as we did in the Great Depression, we'll get down to about 5 or 6. But who knows? It's not a forecast. But I'm saying it's kind of a risky and dangerous situation. We're kind of like where the U.S. was in, that's around 1931 or 32. Let's hope that it just all turns out to be nothing. Nothing much more. But I want to show you home prices. And the red line is U.S. home prices, a series that I constructed for my book from 1890 until the fourth quarter of 2008. Okay, and that's again corrected for inflation. So this is what the price of a standard home was, basically, as much as I could get it over 100 years. And look what happened recently. It had this enormous run-up and then collapsed. So prices essentially doubled. This is nationwide. When did it ever do that before? Well, there's only one time before, which is anywhere comparable, and that's this period. See that period? You know what that's called? That's a different boom. It has a name. It's the baby boom, yeah. After World War II, the soldiers came home, and they started having babies. And so there was a tremendous demand. You actually wanted a two-bedroom house when you had a baby. You don't want that baby in the room all the time. So people needed more housing. And there wasn't housing available because they had shut down the construction industry during the war. But that's really different. What seemed to happen this time in the... I can go over here for one. During this, I can find it. I've lost it. There we are. During this run-up here, is that we got very speculative. You compare these two periods, it's very different. This period in the 1940s to early 1950 was not a time of speculation. It wasn't like, I'm going to make a lot of money trading in real estate, I'm going to flip houses and sell them at double my money and so much. That was just not there. What were they saying? If you read newspapers from that time, during the baby boom, they would say, maybe it's just as well to wait. You know, you're young and you want this extra bedroom, you want this nice house. But, you know, they're building houses as fast as they can. And don't rush into it. You know, just take your time. That's totally the opposite of what we're saying now. Another funny thing about this chart is notice that there's no increase in prices in 100 years. 1890 prices were about the same as 1990 prices. And that surprises a lot of people, because one thing that got on our mind during this recent boom is that housing is this amazing investment. It just goes up in price all the time. Make sure you get into the housing market as soon as you can, or you might get priced out. But it doesn't seem to be supported by these data. Moreover, I looked back reading old newspapers and magazines to try to find when this idea appeared, and it had, it kind of seemed like it came on gradually, but it came on really strong in here. I think it was the idea that drove the bubble. You could find isolated examples of someone saying housing is a great investment. You could find, I found someone in 1885 in a newspaper in New York saying, Manhattan is getting crazy. They said, there's no land available on Manhattan. Would you believe it? Every new building going up in Manhattan is 6 stories tall. They said they can't keep getting higher forever. And so the prices have to go up. But the interesting thing is they were only talking about Manhattan. He didn't say the whole country. And I think what generally people thought was, well, you know, houses are appreciating assets. They they wear out, they go out of style, you gotta spend a lot of money to keep them going. I would never invest in one just as an investment. I'd buy it if I want to live there. But something happened and we started to think of them as this great investment for a while. And it caused us, people were buying two or three houses as long as the price is going up. But as soon as the price isn't going up anymore, they don't want two or three houses. They were just holding them to make money. And so it becomes a collapse. And I think this price increase that we saw here is not explained by building costs, by population, or interest rate. It's really a social phenomenon. It's a bubble. I wanted to show you Seattle because we're in Seattle. And I produced what my colleagues and I produced something called the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Home Price Index. And we produced them for many different cities. And they're now traded, or 10 of them are traded on a futures market that we created at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So we rolled out 10 futures markets, and then we had a second 10, including Seattle. And the plan was to start trading Seattle at Chicago. So that's why we have these indexes, but we haven't started that yet. We'll see if we can get that going. But meanwhile, the blue line is Seattle single-family home prices corrected for inflation from 1990 until January of this year. And the red line is the 10-city average, not including Seattle. It's cities like, you know, Boston, New York, Denver, San Francisco, major cities around the country. But the thing, interesting thing is that Seattle looks roughly similar, right? The blue line looks similar to the red line. Seattle has had a boom. It's a little bit different, but the boom in Seattle kind of begins around the late 1990s, same time as the national boom. Looks like the Seattle boom lasted a little bit longer than it did elsewhere in the country. But now it's coming down. Looks like it hasn't come down as much. But basically, it's the same. And I think the thing that is really remarkable is I could do similar plots where I included Sydney, Australia, or Beijing, China, or this real estate boom and bust has been over much of the world. I was just in Moscow recently, a year ago, and I'm interested in bubbles, so I try to talk with the taxi driver, and I try to talk to anyone who say, what's going on with real estate in Moscow? So the taxi driver in Moscow said, I'm gonna show you something. So we drove by the Kremlin, you know, Red Square, and there was this old hotel that they had renovated. And he said, could you believe it? An apartment, now it's being converted into condos. An apartment there sold recently for $100,000 per square foot. No, for square meter, sorry. That's still a lot of money. He said, no place in the world has higher prices than Moscow. Because they had a beautiful view of Red Square and all that. But, now I'm told that they're utterly collapsing in Moscow. And they've fallen in half. And someone said, it's getting so quiet there. You go on the Moscow metro, the subway, there's nobody there. The traffic jams are gone. So this is an example of the same thing happening on the other side of the world. So Seattle and Moscow have a lot more in common. And it's this excitement that comes and goes. The last thing I have, this isn't particularly as interesting. This is Seattle home prices by price tier. Blue is low-priced homes, black is middle-priced homes, and red is high-priced homes. What it shows is that the bubble, I think, infected all levels of the market, but especially the lower level, low-priced homes, did more than the high-priced homes. I think that's partly because of subprime mortgage lending, which was done selectively and maybe irresponsibly to low-income people. It's not as dramatic with Seattle as it is with other cities. So I'm going to stop there. I guess I'll open it up to questions. I haven't entirely elaborated on the theory of bubble. You can read my books. but I think that the general principle is that the economic situation we're in is kind of a social phenomenon at its ground, although when you focus in on it, people will insist that they're being completely rational. But there's some ultra irrationality above it all that makes this whole thing happen. And it's difficult to understand. Anyway, is this appropriate time then to ask if you have any questions. Yes. Oh, shall we, Pat, is there a mic or something? Or I'll repeat your question.
In your local market, Seattle, when you pulled your information, did you pull it off the Northwest MLS or tax base?
It comes from electronic data sources that take it from deeds offices, and it would be for the whole Seattle-Tacoma area. We talk about big metro areas. Does that answer your question? It's not a multiple listing service data.
Okay. And what is a low, middle, high?
It's in thirds. We divide houses into thirds by their price.
What is that?
Well, it's on. If you want to see the data, it's on the Standard & Poor's. Go to www.metroarea.standardandpoors.com, and there they show the price breaks for the three. They seem kind of low because you forget how many low-priced homes there really are. It seems low to me, but I don't remember the numbers. But there isn't actually as much difference for Seattle as there are in other cities. So it looks like Seattle is not particularly dramatic in that respect. Like all three tiers move similarly. Okay, so
I can talk loud. My question has to do with. Now I'm nervous. My question has to do with the recovery of the housing market. And if we've had these two bubbles burst, the stock market and the housing market, and now we're returning to tighter underwriting and credit standards, what impact do you see on that have as far as the housing market recovering eventually? Will it be prolonged?
Well, that's a very difficult question. First of all, I'm not supposed to quantitatively forecast since I produced the indices. And it's, but I can talk about scenarios that actually go back. Talk about this. It looks very spiky when I do the 1890 to the present chart because it's compressed horizontally. When I show Seattle, it's pretty much a similar spike, but it doesn't look as dramatic in this plot. So the question, going back to this national plot, where do you think we'll go from here? Now, I get some help from the Obama administration because they're doing these stress tests, which they're supposed to announce soon. And the Federal Reserve published forecasts. Well, they published a baseline forecast for home prices for their stress test. And they also published an adverse scenario, which is worse than they expected. But they wanted the banks to be strong enough to survive even the adverse scenario. So I didn't show it here, but if you plot their, they go out to 2010. If you plot their baseline forecast, what it's predicting, can't find the red dot. Where is my red dot? The baseline forecast is just going back and just leveling off at where it always was. But the adverse scenario that they have is overshooting. So according to the adverse scenario, the home prices will decline 22% nationwide in 2009 and another 7% in 2010. And they show it still going down at the end of, according to their plot, I'm just reading from their plot. So it looks like they are saying that by sometime in 2011, it might bottom out and
30% from where it is today.
That's adverse. Their adverse scenario.
But from today or from?
That was from December of 2008. But that's exactly where this series ends anyway. So the other thing is we have a futures market that predicts home prices. And the futures market, unfortunately, is not as active as we like. But it's showing something like their forecasts. So that seems to be a consensus among, that doesn't mean it's right at all, but among people who do these forecasts. And you can look at economy.com does forecasts, and Jan Hatzius at Goldman Sachs does forecasts, and there are others. That seems to be the kind of story. Absolutely doesn't mean it's going to happen. But I do think that it can't keep falling at this rate indefinitely, because it's going to really overshoot if it does. And so, actually, in our last monthly price reports, we found that the rate of decline is slowing. The OFAO index has actually showed a couple monthly increases. There's other signs that the rate of catastrophe is diminishing. Bubbles burst and then they're done. They don't just fall forever. It's got but I don't know that it's going to go shooting back up, because this behavior was so anomalous by historical standards. It reminds me also, I did a op-ed piece for the Los Angeles Times. I may have told this story the other night. I didn't. I give so many public talks, I don't remember what story I told. But somewhere recently I told the story. In 1885, Los Angeles had a housing boom. Now, people find that amazing. Did I say that right? 1885. That's in the days of cowboys and Indians, right? And they had this housing boom in Los Angeles. There's no data on it, but apparently, judging from the LA Times, it was kind of like that. And what happened? Well, what happened was the railroad started giving cut rate fares to Los Angeles, and people from out east said, hey, let's just go to Los Angeles. We can do it. This was new in 1885. Get on that train, and in 5 days, you're in Los Angeles. And people went there and they just fell in love with the place, and there were real estate agents there waiting for them. And they had brass bands and they had free refreshments, and they were dividing it up into housing projects, and they had special names and they had brochures. And so people went back out east and they started coming in more and more, and housing prices started going up. And then it became exciting. Everybody in America knew that Los Angeles was booming in 1885. And it still seems amazing to me. I thought, wait a minute, there was nobody in California. There's all this empty land. How can they have a boom in Los Angeles? It took me a while to kind of figure that out. I think people thought it wasn't just California is special. Los Angeles is special. And they had these beautiful, there was some nice, it was nice, actually. Nice architecture, beautiful weather. And they got carried away. And they started bidding up these home prices, and newspapers out east started saying, this is crazy, they can't be worth that much. And then they suddenly fell. And I saw a beautiful article in the LA Times from 1886. They had good writers back then, so the writer was describing the bust in Los Angeles home price. And he said something quite remarkable. He said, we Californians have learned something, and that is that home prices can't just go up forever. They have to be supported by something. And otherwise they'll come down. And then he said, never again will Californians make this mistake. So actually, he was sort of right, because it wasn't for another 100 years that Californians did it again. And then when I talked to the editor of the LA Times, I said, can I write about your 1885 boom? Because everybody knows about it in California, right? And the editor said, what 1885? I read this in your newspaper. He never heard of it. So, you know, eventually 100 years goes by and we completely erase all of our memories. But the critical thing that was different about the 1885 LA boom is it was just LA, and it was other Southern California. It didn't make it up to San Francisco. It didn't make it up to Seattle. What was here in Seattle in 1885? I can tell you that it didn't have a boom then. And everything was more local. What's happened now is this idea that housing anywhere, you can go anywhere, and it's a spectacular investment. That is the new idea that drove this this huge. I think it's tied to an idea, I'm giving you too long an answer maybe. It's tied to the idea that has gotten into our mind recently, that the world is developing very fast, and capitalism is triumphant, and there's all these rich people in. Now they're in China and India, and they're coming over here. They're doing that in Seattle, right? Isn't that the story? The Chinese are coming and they're buying everything up? Maybe that's more of a Vancouver story, but it's a Seattle story too, I think. And these are just rumors and ideas that encourage people to think that, boy, I better just get into the housing market. But it only really flourishes when prices are going up. And when they start falling, people start reassessing. So that's where we are. I didn't give you a very concrete forecast, but so maybe we'll go for another 100 years before we have a real boom like that again.
Okay.
So,
excuse me. Yeah. Do you feel that the government intervention has been beneficial to the system, and you can do the housing market as well?
Well, the government interventions under both the Bush and the Obama regime are efforts to save a sinking ship. Things are happening very fast, and the financial people told them that, you know, the financial system is so interconnected that if you let one big institution fail, it has all kinds of deals and debts and obligations and connections. It's going to all be this huge morass that's going to collapse the whole system. So the government, you know, bailed out Bear Stearns and AIG because they thought that they couldn't let it happen. When they let Lehman Brothers fail, and that they thought that was a safer one, apparently, but it caused big turmoil in September. And so they kind of think, we can't let that happen again. We don't know where the system is going to go if we just let the whole thing collapse. And so I think, is it right or is it not? Now, I heard Larry Summers, who's the basically the chief economic advisor to Obama, speak the other night, and he was kind of telling us about the loneliness of the person in charge. I think Paulson had said something different. Lots of people love to jump on either Henry Paulson, or who was Treasury Secretary under Bush, or Larry Summers, who's head of the National Economic Council under Obama. But Summers was complaining, I can't get anyone to tell me what I should be doing with any authority. There are like a million different ideas, but all of them kind of half-baked. I get them in my email all the time. Someone has a new plan for the president. And they come in such numbers that I don't know how to, there's too many of them, and I don't know how to think through them. And so ultimately, we just have a system that isn't working. It's like the Titanic is going down, and we don't have time to figure it out. We just have to try something, and that's kind of what's going on, I think. So I give them credit for trying something. It's not as bad as the Titanic going down. Even in the Great Depression, I was chastised once by a woman who, I would say, even in the Great Depression, nobody starved. And a woman emailed me, I don't know who she was, she said, my family was starving in the Great Depression. So I thought I'd better check that out. Was I wrong? I thought nobody starved in the Great Depression. But I went back and I studied that. I found out that there were lots of bread lines in soup kitchens. And so they did have a plan to feed everybody in the Great Depression. However, there were studies that showed that malnutrition was up. They studied children, and they found that there were more malnourished children. What was apparently happening is their parents were in deep distress, and they should have been taking them to the soup kitchen. But, you know, things were... They were even doing that, but they weren't giving them a good diet, and then kids were getting rickets and problems. And, so I guess I was sort of... I was sort of wrong to say that nobody was starving, but it wasn't like a famine or anything like that, because anyone who was hungry could go downtown to the soup kitchen and they would feed anybody. So it's not that bad, but it is a concern that I suspect even in this recession there's a rise in malnutrition. Are you all nourished here? Yeah.
To what degree do bubbles begin other bubbles? You know, recently we had the 90s stock market, and then we had housing. Even last year, oil bubbled and crashed. Right. And it gives the appearance that speculative money moves from one sector to the other. But is that really what happens?
Well, this is one of those questions that Larry Summers couldn't get answered, because there's no economic authority who does research on that question. In fact, economists generally don't even like to think about bubbles. It's not in the textbooks. But I think that they do beget other bubbles. But in a sense, it's the story that lies behind a bubble that begets other bubbles. So I think that the stock market bubble of the 1990s is in substantial measure the cause of the real estate bubble of the 2000s. Now, I have to explain that, what I mean by that. The stock market boom of the 1990s, it really affected our whole culture. It changed people's views of their careers and their idea of who I am and what my relation to society is. What happened in the 1990s is that some people seemed to be making money so fast in the stock market that it was crazy. People would boast about having made money in the stock market that was more than you've made in your job all year. And it caused, people were envious. And envy is a powerful emotion. And people wanted to get in on this. Even if they didn't know for sure whether it was a bubble, they wanted to be in on it. So it changed everything. We started developing all these business magazines, and we started, newspapers added a money section or a business section, and people started to think that that's what I should follow. And during, people started to develop their skills as a conversationalist about the stock market, because that worked well to impress the opposite sex, for example, that you would know about, or at least people thought it impressed them, I don't know. That led to a self-image change. People thought, I'm an investor and I should be making money. I shouldn't be a sucker who works in some humdrum job, taking someone's orders. After the stock market bubble burst, there was a downer that some people felt foolish for having participated in what turned out to be a bubble. But it didn't really change their thinking. And so they began to think, I just have to find another investment. And housing seemed to be it. Now, I mean, maybe I won't, but I actually did, I tried to find some evidence on one of my questionnaire surveys. I've been surveying investors, or homebuyer, that's homebuyer. I asked the question, this was 5 years ago, during the debacle in the stock market between 2000 and 2003. I said, did the behavior of the stock market encourage you or discourage you from investing in homes? And they overwhelmingly said it encouraged. A stock market decline, they said, encouraged them to invest in homes. And then I asked their follow-up question, why did it encourage you? And paraphrasing what people said, a lot of people said something like this. This is when the stock market was falling rapidly and the housing market was going up. They said something like, well, you know, I used to trust my broker and he told me I could make a lot of money, but I'm just fed up with this stock market business. I want something that I can trust. And real estate is solid, it's bricks and mortar. I live there, I can look around, and it gives me great satisfaction every day to look at my investment around me. And I want to be able to see it. And I know that this investment is going to win in the long run, because housing has always gone up. Stock market goes up and down. So this is, and that was the kind of, it sounds silly, but that's the kind of attitude that I think, I read it in their answers. But I think they were encouraged by the experience of living through stock market boom. And then their mind just went, they couldn't accept the idea that I was a foolish investor participating in a bubble, that is not, that's cognitive dissonance. I had a couple of people say that to me, who were very candid, but most people, they just had to find some other way to rescue their self-esteem, and they did it by switching investments. You won't hear this explanation from any other economist. Yes?
In this period of declining house prices and values, why is it that with so many short sales going on in the market, entities like Bank of America, Wachovia, Washington Mutual, Countrywide, are taking 6 to 12 months to get back on offers?
To rework a mortgage?
No, offers to purchase these short sale distressed properties. And why is the government giving these entities money without compelling them to respond more quickly?
I'm not a representative of the government. There may be a bias. This is something I talked about in my book. It may be reflecting somebody's thinking. And the government would justify bailing out these companies because of the systemic risk. The idea that if we lose our banking system, we're in real trouble. And we can't, I know I heard Dow Summers talk about this, it's funny to hear a Democratic economist say that. Basically, he said, I'm basing it on a principle of conservatism. That doesn't sound Democratic. But he said, I don't want to rock the boat. these institutions are fundamental to our economy. But they're allowing the boat to be rocked for all these people who are being foreclosed on. And they're not, well, especially under the Bush administration, they weren't coming to coming forth to protect them. And I think it may have been a lapse. Under Obama, Obama now has a plan called the Housing Affordability and Stability Plan, which is $275 billion involving TARP money and also other sources to help bail out homeowners. But he's not, you're saying that he should ask Bank of America to do a bailout?
Well, what I'm wondering specifically is
that... It's out of money itself, so it has
granted,
trouble doing
but
that.
There are so many houses that are being offered for less money than is owed on them, these short sales.
Right.
And yet these entities are often taking 6 months to a year to process offers to purchase these distressed properties. And no one seems to be inclined to compel them to actualize getting the dead wood off of the books and stimulating a healthier real estate economy.
Well, I think that what's often happening, we are seeing foreclosures move pretty fast. And so a lot of people are being kicked out of their homes fast. The incentives may not be exactly right. We have mortgage servicers who are in charge of servicing a mortgage, and they have a contract which was signed years ago telling them that providing incentives for them to act fast. And so that's what's happening fast. People are being thrown out of their homes. Mortgage servicers, if the person is still occupying payments and is delinquent in payments, the mortgage servicer often has to make good on the payments until he or she takes action against the homeowner. So they have tremendous incentive to kick people out fast. But what I'd like to see happen is workouts. Workouts would be better. A workout is where the mortgage servicer tells you, okay, you can't pay, we're going to reduce your balance. And that is not happening. So that people remain under, unless you're talking about a short sale, people are underwater, their home is worth less than they owe. Nobody is doing anything about that. Now, there was something done about that during the Great Depression, because the Homeowners Loan Corporation in 1933 persuaded lenders to lower the balance on mortgages. And they gave them government guarantees if they agreed to lower the balance. And they actually bailed out 20% of all mortgages in the U.S. and lowered the balances and put them into long-term 15-year mortgages. We haven't done anything as radical as that. So we're not up to the Roosevelt administration in dealing with this problem. I think maybe it's a political problem. It's hard. People from I heard a talk from someone from the Bush administration who was behind some of the programs that they launched. But the same theme came up that they felt so politically constrained, it's so difficult to do anything that would get approval from them. And so they were very slow to deal with this problem. The foreclosure problem is the big unmet problem that continues right now, and I think it's causing a huge... So we have to be able to do something more about it, but still it's politically difficult.
Dr. Schiller, are there any signs that you're looking for particularly to symbolize a lasting bottom in residential real estate?
Well, I've been looking at the consumer confidence indexes, which are starting to come up. But I note that those indices are very unstable and they often reverse. So I think we've had good luck lately. The stock market is up in the last month or so. The government seems to be taking actions. We're going to get the stress test details announced soon. But there were some optimistic, Geithner expressed some optimistic opinions about the solvency of our banks. So we're in a good moment. But and so confidence is looking up. But I'm not sure that it will hold. Maybe the principal thing is just looking at that picture. It does seem plausible to me, especially since the rate of decline is seemingly slowing a little bit, that this thing is going to be like a nice bell-shaped curve. That's not a forecast, but it's going to go up like this, then it's going to go down, it's going to go like that. That's not a forecast. It's really hard to forecast this series now because it's never had a bubble like this before. And it's the first one, so how do you forecast it? So maybe I'm basing it on various stories. I told you Los Angeles. That's what Los Angeles did in 1885. Then it went down, and then it went level for another 100 years. And then here it is. It did this and this and then this. Something like that. I honestly don't know what the markets are going to do. The suspicion, though, still is that for the next year or two, it's still going to be a tough market. One more question.
I have a question. From 1982 till 2000, I worked for Bear Stearns on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Bear Stearns in
Chicago. I ran their stock index desk. First of all, a couple questions. The contract that you devised, is there sizable open interest? Is it being used as a hedging vehicle?
The open interest is the total value of the contract. We launched it in May of 2006. The open interest never got very big. At its peak, it was about $120 million. And it's been declining since. And it's down to something like $20 million, which is by Wall Street standards, very poor. The CME has decided to put a new person in charge of the index, the real estate futures. Another thing that I've been doing with my colleague, I have a company called Macro Markets, and actually tomorrow we're opening an auction on real estate securities. It's actually tomorrow. that will allow people to invest on the New York Stock Exchange in real estate securities. And it'll be kind of a parallel to the futures market, if it works. And then we're hoping to get the market going. The idea is that you need multiple markets. You can't just have a futures market. There's no cash market for real estate. So we're trying to create the analog of a cash market. So our auction will be on E-Trade. If you want
to have one more question.
Yeah.
Having worked for Bear Stearns and watching the firm run by Ace Greenberg, and then to be taken over by Jimmy Cain, behavioral side, we marked to market, we evaluated positions every night, and then watch the firm go to basically Jamie Dimon tried to garner the firm at $2 a share. The government came in and said no 10. In your behavioral process, how does a firm that has run that well, even though Ace Greenberg was still on the board of directors, decline that fast?
It seems like these people are human and they have their limits, and I think that complacency actually infected the highest people's thinking, and including Alan Greenspan. I think it's our theories about we've been living in a regime where pride in our markets and our financial technology got excessive. And someone who's of high, great success and apparently high intelligence and knowledge is not immune from that. It may seem opposed. There's a book that was written about 30 years ago by Irving Janis, who was a social psychologist, called Groupthink. And I think maybe he coined the term groupthink. But what he described in that book was a number of case studies of expert commissions or boards of directors and the like who made colossal errors. And the conclusion of his book is that even very smart people put together in a room to solve a problem can make big errors. What he did is interviewed people who were there on found examples of boards or committees that made big errors. And people reminiscing about it later, how did we make these errors? They talked about kind of an idea that a consensus had emerged and I was afraid to challenge it. And you might say, well, wait a minute, you are a famous, powerful person. Why were you afraid to challenge it? And they said, well, maybe I wasn't afraid, but I kind of thought I shouldn't. I can't constantly be disagreeing. I don't want to rock the boat. Other people told me not to rock the boat. And I'm oversimplifying, but it does happen. We get into an idea that certain things are safe and secure, and everybody says they're safe, and I'm going to shut up. I have heed my opinions to myself that are too far out. And so nobody ever says that, it worries. And if nobody ever says it, it gets lost, and it doesn't... That's why you need a good business education to encourage you to stand up and say the things that are right.